Welcome to this week's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Offit, Chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the Director of the Vaccine Education Center at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is also the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Offit is a founding advisory board member of the Autism Science Foundation, and his latest book is Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. He's here with us today to discuss his Wall Street Journal op-ed, Junk Science Isn't a Victimless Crime. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I think one of the really interesting aspects of your work and of your article in the journal is the fact that Andrew Wakefield, who was the British researcher who first posited a link in The Lancet between vaccines and autism, has had his work discredited virtually since the moment the article appeared in The Lancet. And yet the myth that vaccines are in any way related to autism continues to survive in the United States and then in Great Britain, virtually despite all the efforts of real scientists and real studies that have disproven it. Could you talk for a moment about where the breakdown was, in effect, in medical science's guardians at the journal, what they should have been doing, and how we've gotten to the place where we are now, where we're required to debunk this thing again and again?
Well, I think the breakdown was at the level of publication. In other words, what Andrew Wakefield submitted with 12 other authors, co-authors, was a story of 12 children, 8 of whom had autism. Of those 8 children, they all had received the MMR vaccine. They all had developed signs and symptoms of autism within a month of receiving that vaccine. And according to Dr. Wakefield, by endoscopy, meaning when you take a look at the lining of the small intestine, you could see, according to him, evidence of increased activity of the kind of the lymph system, the system that one uses to help fight infection. So he posited that was a syndrome. Now, it's 4 of the 6 people that reviewed that paper rejected it because they felt this was not nearly enough evidence to claim a syndrome, that MMR vaccine had done this, thus causing autism. And so it worked. Right there it worked. The problem was the editor of the journal, Richard Horton, who I think has moved from editorship into something more akin to a journalist, thought it was interesting and thought he would just put it out there. And if science works, which I think it invariably does, then no one will be able to show that his hypothesis is correct, that MMR causes autism. The thing that's important is that was never a study. What he put into The Lancet was not a study. It was simply a case series. And so when the media said recent study shows or important study shows, it was never a study because nothing was studied. And science works, and that when people did do a study, when they looked at hundreds of thousands of children who did or didn't receive the MMR vaccine to find there was no increased incidence of autism, science worked because his hypothesis was incorrect. But that's all it was. It was just a hypothesis, and for that reason, it should have never been published. I think the reason that it doesn't go away is that we don't really know the cause or causes of autism, and until that happens, I think this kind of, you know, quackery is always going to appear. People will always say, well, I know what the cause is, even though the medical establishment doesn't.
But the issue, too, is that we had an editor who took it upon himself, you know, to publish something with the thought that just being provocative, but provocative ideas are perhaps not the right form in a medical journal. That might be an opinion editorial, but not for a medical journal.
I think that there are provocative ideas that end up being right. I mean, it was a provocative idea that proteins could cause an infection. It was Stanley Prusiner's idea. He believed protein could cause a disease. We all knew viruses or bacteria or fungi or parasites could cause diseases, but all of those organisms have their own genetic material that instruct them how to reproduce themselves. That's not true of a single protein, but that was right. That wild idea was right and ultimately won Stanley Prusiner a Nobel Prize for what we now know to be proteinaceous infectious particles, or prions, the cause of mad cow disease. Or Albert Einstein, you know, who believed that light was actually made of discrete particles, and he proved that showing light could essentially be bent by the gravitational energy of the sun. And that, too, was a novel and shocking idea that ended up being right, and that, too, earned a Nobel Prize for Albert Einstein. So I think it's okay to put an interesting hypothesis out there, but in this setting, where you're talking about a vaccine as a cause of autism without having any really solid data to show that that's true, it's just too dangerous. Because then what can happen is what did happen, which is that especially in the United Kingdom and in Ireland. Parents abandoned the vaccine. There were thousands of children that became infected. Hundreds were hospitalized, and four died. I mean, died from a vaccine-preventable disease. That's unconscionable. And I think any journal editor who thinks it's okay to publish a hypothesis, you just have to be very, very circumspect about the kind of hypothesis that can have this kind of negative public health implication. I just think it was unconscionable.
And what kind of caveats that you put around a hypothesis to signal to journalists and others in the community that this is just a hypothesis and that's far from being proved?
What was done in that particular journal edition in February of 1998 was you had an editorial by Bob Chen and Frank DiStefano, both of whom were in the Immunization Safety Office here at this Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which basically said, this paper doesn't make sense. And I think he did that to try and soften the blow of that paper, but obviously it didn't, because the media saw it as a study, even though it wasn't, and ran with it as fact, and it scared parents.
What can we do today? As you point out, there are outbreaks of contagious diseases that can be prevented by vaccines among children all across the U.S. for a number of different diseases, from measles, mumps, bacterial meningitis, and whooping cough. What can we do to change the atmosphere? I mean, I think that you pointed out the Lancet has, over the last 10 years or so, retracted the study, the hypothesis, as more evidence has come out that it's increasingly wrong and bad and now even fraudulent. What can we do to reassure parents, anything more than we're doing already, that vaccines are, for the vast majority of children, incredibly safe?
What struck me actually when I wrote the book is that what's happening now in the United States isn't new. I mean, it's happened over and over again, and you can in fact draw parallels to really the first organized anti-vaccine activity, which took place, not surprisingly, with the first vaccine in England, the smallpox vaccine. And associated with something called the Compulsory Vaccination Act in the mid-1800s, there was a tremendous sort of organized anti-vaccine movement that ultimately led in the late 1800s to this sort of Anti-Compulsory Vaccination Act, whereby people could conscientiously object. And you could get a certificate of conscientious objection that you didn't want to get vaccinated. Actually, the birth of the term conscientious objector was for this. It was for people who didn't want to get vaccines. It was later applied to those who didn't want to serve in the war. And so that's what happened. So what happened in England is that many people chose not to get the smallpox vaccine. Now, this wasn't true in Scotland. It wasn't true in Ireland. It wasn't true in Wales. And what happened was that England became the epicenter for smallpox. There was far more smallpox than smallpox deaths in England than there were in those other countries where people really didn't conscientiously object. So this is a lesson that you'd like to think was already learned, but apparently not. And this is the old Santayana quote, right? Those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it, and so we're condemned to repeat it. And now children are dying of diseases like whooping cough, and they're being hospitalized by diseases like measles or bacterial meningitis, dying from bacterial meningitis. And so what teaches us this is the only way that we're going to learn to have more and more children die to the point that we say, okay, this is enough, or can we believe in the germ theory that germs cause infections and that preventing them will prevent infections? And that the safest thing we can do for our children is to make sure they're protected against these diseases. You'd like to think we don't have to resort to human sacrifice to get people's attention that this is a bad thing, but maybe that's the only thing it's going to take.
And we've had data this year that show that, I think for the first time ever, perhaps, that more children with private insurance are being vaccinated at lower rates, even for children in the Medicaid program, which is a surprising turn given the fact that Medicaid reimbursements are often so low, doctors will sometimes not see children with Medicaid coverage. And also that in the whooping cough outbreak in California, I understand some of the most affluent counties in California have the highest rates of whooping cough. Some evidence that the more affluent or internet savvy parents are, the less likely they are to have their children vaccinated, which kind of turns the thesis on its head that the more educated, the more proactive you are, the more you should know and therefore be comfortable with vaccines. But that seems not to be the case with what's happening now.
You're right. It seems counterintuitive. And it actually is the exact opposite of what was seen in sort of mid-19th century England, where those who chose not to vaccinate were the less educated. Those who were better educated, you know, saw this vaccine for what it was, which was something that worked and it could save their lives. That's not true today. I mean, if you look at a generally medically underserved population in the city of Philadelphia, those parents tend to believe their doctors and believe that their doctor may know more than they do about this issue and choose to get vaccinated. But it's generally an upper middle class or upper class group who believe that they can, by searching the term vaccines on the internet, know just as much as their doctor or by those who recommend vaccines at the Centers for Disease Control or the American Academy of Pediatrics. It's hard to watch. I think it hits at something that's really very much fundamental to us in the United States, which is the notion of freedom of choice, that freedom to make a healthcare choice is the freedom to make the wrong choice, and that we should stand back and let that happen. But the fact is, I think it's very different when you make a choice for yourself than when you make a choice for your child. And if you make a bad choice for your child, I think at some point, you know, when is society responsible for preventing that from happening?
I think you said in the past, you think that the media has really caught up to the issue in terms of the science. Obviously, I think the physician community, helped in part by your own efforts, is becoming more proactive. You know, for instance, I have a young child at home, and we took him into our pediatrician's office. There was a sign on the wall that said, if you don't want to have your child vaccinated, take your child somewhere else because we're not going to serve you in this office. So I think their physicians are being more proactive. Is there something that you think might tip the scale short of, as you point out, just waiting for more children to die?
Yeah, I think physicians are in a tough spot because on the one hand, they could say, look, let me love your child. You can't ask me to practice substandard care, which would put your child in harm's way. I can't do that. I've seen, as we see in Philadelphia, children have died from a bacterial form of meningitis called Haemophilus influenza type B. If you're telling me I can't give your child that vaccine, knowing what's going on out there, knowing that that could hurt your child, I just can't do it. I understand that the physician's point of view there, but on the other hand, if you choose not to vaccinate that child, then what happens? Do they simply go to a chiropractor or a physician who's far more willing not to give the vaccine? You know, ultimately, you're the child's advocate. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know. I don't think that doing things like restricting religious exemptions, which are often used as kind of a pop-off valve for people who just don't want to get vaccines, period, or philosophical exemptions, which is available in 21 states, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, ultimately, I think the attitude is going to have to change because the fact of the matter is when you choose not to vaccinate yourself or your child, you're not only making a choice for yourself or your child, you're making a choice for those who come in contact with you or your child. And there are 500,000 people roughly in the United States who can't be vaccinated because they're getting chemotherapy for their cancer or immunosuppressive therapy for their transplants or their rheumatologic diseases. They depend on those around them to be protected. And you're starting to hear from them now. I mean, you're starting to hear parents that are angry that they have a child, say, with leukemia who's going to a daycare center, and they want to know exactly how many people in that daycare center aren't vaccinated because they know it puts their child at special risk. So I think the only thing that really changes this is when we see ourselves as part of something greater, as part of an immunological commons, that we really all are dependent on each other, which I think asks for a change in a general attitude, which is far more selfish and self-serving.
Well, that's a terrific point to end on. Dr. Robert, thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to hearing more about vaccine education in the future.
Thank you, Paul.